As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Total Soccer Show, and a show we're dedicating to the league that arguably gave us the most compelling and dramatic season-long title race of any league, Serie A. Milan are champions for the first time in 11 years. They pit their rivals Inter to the Scudetto on the final day, sparking jubilant celebrations in Emilia-Romagna and sparking cigars in Zlatan's mouth. The third horse in the race, Napoli, finished in third, and Juventus secured themselves Champions League soccer once again in a season they might not look back upon too fondly. The Roman teams, meanwhile, will both be in Europe next year, and the Venice fashion brand, they're going to be down in Serie B once again. My name is Ryan Bailey. Joining me today to talk Calcio is a Rome-based Serie A journalist and a Scot who knows a lot about soccer. Finally, we have one of those on the show. Alistair McKenzie, welcome. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. And thanks for the wonderful introduction.
Oh, you're very welcome, Alistair. Very, very welcome to have you here today. You may have seen Alistair's work in The Times, in the iPaper, Eurosport, 442, BBC, CNN. The list goes on and on and on. And Alistair, you're a podcaster too. Is that right?
I am. Yeah. I mean, it's a club-specific podcast in my case. I co-host one called Lazio Lounge, all about the first team of Rome, obviously, Lazio. So, if we happen to have any Lazio, English-speaking Lazio fans listening to this, please check it out. Why not? Oh,
okay, so a little bit about your story then, Alistair, before we get going. We're in Rome. We're both in Rome. You're a Lazio fan, presumably. How long have you been covering Serie A, and what brought you to choose the Dolce Vita?
Yeah, well, I mean, any UK... based people of my kind of generation will be familiar with a TV show called Football Italia that was on in the kind of 90s into the early 2000s. And basically it was showing free to air Italian football every weekend. You know, I grew up in a household where my parents didn't watch any football. So we didn't have the paid subscriptions on Sky and so on. So I couldn't actually really watch any football other than Italian football in that period. And I eventually picked up Lazio as my team, more or less, sadly to say, because they were absolutely incredible back then. And I had a fascination with Rome as a city as well. And yeah, so that was where the kind of love began. I mean, it is an incredible league. I do love it to bits. I would have given up long ago if it wasn't for the fact that it just sucks you in. It's a massive soap opera. You don't get the kind of characters and the storylines and the ridiculousness really in any other division, in my opinion. And went into sports journalism eventually, obviously, as a career, moved out to Rome in 2018. So I've been here coming on for 4 years now, and covering every step. And it's been quite a good time, really, because it's become a far more competitive league in that period. And obviously Milan yesterday clinching it, we've now had three title winners in 3 years. So finally we've got the Juve period of dominance is over, and we're back to having a competitive league again.
Yeah, things getting very interesting at the moment. And I love that you mentioned Gazzetta Football Italia, the show that was on British TV back in the day. I think I might be a little older than you, Alistair, but we're around the same age. And I agree with you. That was the only soccer I had access to when I was that age, because the Premier League, as it became, was put on paid for cable TV, if you will. And it was Paul Gascoigne who went and played for Lazio at that period, I believe. And he actually, funnily enough, he lived in the neighbourhood that I live in now. And so, because I live pretty near to Formello where Lazio train. And yeah, that started my love affair with Italian soccer as well, I'd say. And it's kind of, yeah, brought me here today. So a similar journey, if you will.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Gazza as well, you know, he's just one of these players that everybody fell in love with. I think everywhere he's been, he's remembered so fondly. And it's really amazing how it's exactly the same here, because he came to Lazio as a big name and it was a long time ago. Now we're talking about 1994. But he's still remembered so fondly by the fans, despite only spending 3 years at the club and actually not being able to play an awful lot of football in that time without, you know, bar the odd incredible goal that he did obviously score. So the strength of his personality was something else. And I think he did a hell of a lot, to be honest, to increase the image of the league, certainly in the UK.
Definitely so. One more question for you, Alistair, before we get to the teams itself and this season itself. Can you tell us a little bit what it's like covering Serie A? I mean, every weekend you're going up and down the country. You were at Sassuolo, obviously, over the weekend for Milan's title win. You're covering a lot of ground. You're on a lot of trains, I presume. What's it like on a day-to-day basis, visiting all these different parts of Italy and seeing all these different soccer cultures, if you will?
Fascinating, yeah. I mean, it is a really interesting country for that, because it's fiercely tribal, as football always is, but Italy, as I'm sure you're getting to grips with, is a very a country that's very proudly regionalized, and so these clubs represent something more than just a football club to a lot of these people. It's also the city or the area or whatever, and you do see that everywhere you go. You know, Naples is almost something of its own, really, because it's a massive city and a one club city, which is a very very unique thing. Whereas in big cities like Milan and Rome, you've obviously got the massive rivalries that have really stored up over years and years. And yeah, I mean, within the country, smaller rivalries you might not know as much about, like in Genoa, like in Reggio Emilia, that are every bit as fierce, perhaps on a smaller scale, as the rest. So it's a fascinating football culture. You know, I'm still learning a lot about it as I, like you say, travel around and visit places, because I think that's the way that you really pick up on, I guess, the kind of minutiae of how people actually live their support of their clubs. So yeah, it's a great place to visit as well, to watch football. You know, football tourism wise, I would encourage people as much as possible, even if they're here for other reasons, for romantic holidays or family holidays. If you can get to a game while you're here, it's always worth doing, because facilities are generally pretty poor and the stadiums are always crumbling, but the atmosphere is almost unmatched.
Yeah, it's part of the charm, I guess, though. We've had some questions submitted on Twitter, Alistair, one of which from Alex Izvicky asks about the north-south divide in Italian soccer. So if we could talk a bit about the dynamics, I mean, the power kind of mirrors the economics of the country, where a lot of the power's in the north, but you've got these hotbeds, as you say, like Naples with Napoli, and the Roman teams are also strong. And I'm thinking about it almost as an upside down version of the UK, or England, I should say, sorry, where, you know, the power's in the south, so to speak. And could you compare, say, Naples to like Newcastle, one team town, where, you know, there's a big club there as well? There's some similarities there?
You know, I never really thought of it that way, but yeah, I guess you could. It's a similar dynamic, I guess, in the sense of the feeling of the power base being in the north, and then obviously the wealth largely being in the north as well. I mean, as a general rule, the country becomes poorer the further south you go, but there's a lot of historic beef, I guess, that's been built up over the years. There's a lot of what's become termed as territorial discrimination, which is now almost on a par with actual racism in Italy in terms of the fines that, that can be given out for it or the punishments handed out by the league because of the amount of, well, because of the kind of chants and the nature of the chants that are directed at teams like, well, particularly Napoli from almost everyone they play. So there's definitely a huge divide in the country in terms of north-south. Rome doesn't really fit into that, though. Rome is kind of like an outlier in that it is pretty much bang in the center, and it doesn't really fit in either of those descriptions as northern or southern. Northern people would probably say otherwise, but it is a bit of an outlier in that whole debate. But then obviously further south you go, Calabria, Puglia, and then down to Sicily as well. There have been some fantastic clubs from those areas who've been in Serie A and done very well in Serie A, you know, likes of Palermo, Catania, Bari, Lecce. Recently we've had Crotone, Benevento in the top league, for example. And it's there's a rich football culture down there as well, but it's certainly something I like to see. I think it adds more to the league in my mind to have as much of that mix as possible for it to be a cross-country well-represented division as much as possible as well. I think it adds an extra richness.
Definitely so. All right, let's get to the action of this season then. We should probably start off with the Scudetto champions, Milan. Tell us what it was like on Sunday. You made the trip up to Sassuolo. Very hot, I understand. What was the atmosphere like? We were told around 18,000 Milan fans. And what does it hold, 24,000? So like three quarters of the stadium was basically a home game for Milan.
I'm almost sure it was more than that. It has to have been. I mean, I posted one picture on Twitter, and if you look at it, unless there's a lot more in the stand I was in that I couldn't see, but you try and find a green shirt in that picture, good luck, because it was a sea of red, really. The away stand to my left, the main tribune in front of me was pretty much all Milan, and then the other curva behind the goal to my right, there's a pocket of Sassuolo ultras kind of right behind the goal, but otherwise that stand was entirely Milan fans. It felt like a home game, and it was incredible. I've never seen anything quite like it. You know, there are massive and vociferous away supports everywhere. It's a great part of football when that happens, but I've never seen an opposition stadium being taken over in this way like it was on Sunday. Obviously, it was a hugely important game. Milan just had to avoid defeat, actually, to make sure they won the title. They hadn't won the title in 11 years, and also the other option was losing it to their rivals Inter. So it was a massive day for those fans, and you can understand why they all flooded down there. It's not too far from Milan to Reggio Emilia either, but yeah, it was a complete takeover. Fascinating dynamic, really, and it did feel like a home game, and they performed like it was a home game as well.
Yeah, it did seem like from the outset, like it didn't feel like anything was going to happen except a Milan win. They were coming out the gate swinging, having a few shots in the first 10 minutes. It felt pretty inevitable. John Bishop has asked on Twitter, Alistair, he says, as someone who doesn't intensely keep up with Serie A, what were the key components in Milan's title win and who are the key players? And I suppose I'd ask as well, what did Pioli get right? Because in the past decade, we've seen, you know, legendary players and many other managers try to win the title with the Rossoneri and fail. So what did he do right? What alchemy has he created?
Yeah, I mean, it's he's done an absolutely brilliant job, really. He's a coach who's been around Serie A for a long time. I mean, his career is 19 years long now as a coach, but he's not won a single trophy until yesterday. It's not a case of him having worked his way up from, you know, winning Serie B, Serie C titles or winning Coppa Italias with other teams. He's not won anything in his entire career until yesterday. And so the way he's played this all season long has been perhaps the most impressive thing. He's played this like a guy who's a serial title winner. What I mean by that is the way he's managed the media. You know, there's huge expectations around AC Milan because it's AC Milan and they've got this illustrious history. But he's been very careful to temper expectations, to manage expectations, so there's not any kind of premature hysteria from the support about what could happen. It's been a step-by-step progress really towards this point. It's worth pointing out, yes, this is AC Milan, but no, this was not a team that was supposed to win the title. This was not a title favourite at the start of the season by any means. Inter, although they lost, you know, Antonio Conte, Romelu Lukaku, which I'm sure we'll get onto, last summer, they were still had a far stronger squad. You know, Juve had Allegri back. They're expected to be far more competitive than they were, even Napoli as well. This Milan team wasn't really seen as being this huge contender. So in terms of the what Pioli got right, what the components were, it's really building a team unit that has been greater than the sum of its parts, but also improving those parts as the season's gone along. You know, up until February, they'd actually only spent 1 week on top of the Serie A table. So it was a slow burn of a season for them. So what it came down to was a very, very strong finish, 16 games unbeaten at the end of the season. They barely conceded any goals in that time. So they absolutely locked down the defence. And so the goalkeeper, Mike Maignan, who was brought in to replace Gigi Donnarumma last summer, he's been an absolute revelation. He won Goalkeeper of the Year. In front of him, Fikayo Tomori has been another revelation. He was signed on a permanent deal from Chelsea last summer after a successful loan spell. But then they've had the likes of Sandro Tonali, who was brought into great expectations two seasons ago, but had a fairly disappointing debut season. But he's been incredible, a man possessed really this year, and he's a boyhood Milan fan as well, so this meant everything to him. And then above all, Rafael Leao. I mean, he's just been named player of the season for Serie A, a guy who's always had immense potential, a guy who's always been a lot of fun to watch because he loves to take players on, he loves to, you know, pull out the odd trick. But he's managed to turn that kind of potential into proper productivity this season, you know, hitting double figures for goals and assists. And he's really been the attacking star behind this success. But this isn't really a team that's made up of loads of big stars. You know, if you look at the team that won the last title in 2011, they had, I mean, Zlatan was obviously there, he still is. But they had, you know, Pato was there, Seedorf, Nesta. I mean, they had a ridiculous team then. And Zlatan said this after the game. He said, you know, you can't compare these two titles. Last time we had a team of 22 players who were used to winning everything. They knew how to win everything. This time is a young squad that's never won anything before. So these young players, they've all improved massively. I think Pioli deserves a hell of a lot of credit for that. For giving them, you know, a system and a role that suits them, that allows them to improve, but also by bringing in the experienced guys like Olivier Giroud, like Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who have set the standards and really, you know, shown these players what they need to do to become winners, and said to them as well, you're not here to learn that, you're here to do that. This is AC Milan. This is what's expected. It doesn't matter how young you are. So they've had this consistency, but also this belief and team spirit that's just barreled them towards this title. And every obstacle that's been thrown in front of them, they've managed to knock it down. And that consistency has been something that the other teams have completely lacked. You know, Inter will be kicking themselves because they probably are the most talented team in this league. And if it wasn't for an awful shock defeat against a mid-table Bologna team with nothing to play for, they would have won this title. But Milan didn't do that. So, and that's the reward for consistency. That's the reward for composure. And that's something that Pioli has instilled in this team. So they are absolutely worthy champions in my mind. And I think the players I mentioned massively behind that, but also Stefano Pioli, the work he's done in the last two and a half years to build this piece by piece, to build a champion team again.
And how is Pioli perceived in Italy, in the press and by the people, by the fans? Obviously, he's not a big, well, I don't think he's a big personality. He's not a Mourinho, he's not a Sarri. Is he someone who's going to be gaining a lot more respect now? Obviously, now he's got some silverware.
Well, he was never really the big club coach. You know, he did well in periods. At Lazio, he built a very good team that qualified for the Champions League, the playoffs at least. And at Fiorentina, he did pretty well as well. He earned a lot of plaudits for the way that he dealt with the tragic death of Davide Astori while he was in charge there as well. He's always been a coach that's earned a lot of kind of respect for the way he's held himself and his kind of behaviour and what he's like as a man, I would say. But his teams perhaps have sometimes run out of ideas. That was always my main criticism of him at when he was at Lazio, and then beyond that, Fiorentina and Inter as well, where, you know, things, when they were going well, went brilliantly and his teams were incredible to watch. But when it started going wrong, he seemed to run out of ideas a little bit. But that seems to have changed here at Milan. It's this consistency I was talking about, this absolute steamrolling momentum of his team is very different to what we've seen from previous Pioli teams. So he's definitely developed and improved as his players have. And as a result, he's massively popular. I mean, it was yesterday when I was at the game, I went down to the away end before the match to see the away fans going in and take some pictures and so on. And I found a guy who was there with a banner, it's on my Twitter, that had Pioli kind of mocked up as the Pope with a a halo around his head and saying the new Pope. And, you know, they're all singing Pioli's on Fire, which is their song for him. And Pioli in the second half started dancing along to it because he was able to by that point. So, yeah, there's a great bond between him and the Milan fans as well. He's become a hugely popular figure. He's definitely earned the love and respect that he deserves to have for this achievement.
That's great. And it was good to hear the whole San Siro singing Pioli's on Fire last weekend as well for him. It seemed like a big moment. And you mentioned the idea of running out of ideas in a certain stage of his career. And that leads me to think about next season. This team might look a little different. I mean, Kessié, I believe he's going off to Barcelona. I'm presuming Giroud and Ibra aren't going to be around forever. What do you think this team looks like next season? How do they keep going and maybe even think about a Champions League campaign as well?
Yeah, that's the big question now, and you don't want to take away this moment from Milan fans at all, but there's definitely a sense that this was a fantastic achievement, but this definitely isn't a complete squad, you know, and you know, I should say as well, it's one of the other things Pioli did brilliantly this season was he dealt with the issues that he faced really well. The Kessié contract situation was definitely one of them. That could have turned very, very sour very quickly. Kessié is going to leave at the end of his contract, but he was still in the starting lineup on the final day of the season and scored a goal and was being cheered by the fans. The fact that that's even allowed to happen deserves some plaudits in itself. And then on top of that, you know, this defense I was talking about, Kalulu and Tomori, they weren't the partnership to begin with. I mean, it was Simon Kjær, who had a season-ending injury in December, and so it was Pioli who managed to get Kalulu into that team, having previously played mostly at right back, and he's been an absolute revelation there. So he's dealt with all his problems very well. But sorry, I've completely forgotten what the actual original question was.
Basically, next season, are they going to keep the momentum going and this team might look a little different, and the idea of running out of ideas, if you will?
Yeah, I think that the main one is the striker problem for me, because there was a time not very long ago when that was being talked about as the big issue with this team, is they're not scoring enough goals. They won a couple of games where they couldn't score. Giroud has come up in massive moments for Milan this season. Scored both goals in the derby back in February, scored against Lazio when they had a huge comeback win not long ago, obviously scored twice against Sassuolo, scored the winner against Napoli. But he's not been, you know, your 20-goal-a-season striker that they're going to need going forward. And Ibrahimovic's injury problems as well are only going to get worse, presumably, with age. So they do need a proper option up there. And they're going to have to keep being as smart, I would say, as they have been so far. Paolo Maldini has done a great job as the technical director in terms of the players he's brought in. They've not been, you know, going for the obvious options necessarily, or necessarily the big name stars that they might have been tempted for in years gone by. But they've brought in the likes of Tomori and Maignan and Kalulu, you know, guys who are kind of slightly below the radar. Alexis Sellemakers is another example. That, you know, guys who you maybe wouldn't really know an awful lot about or have seen an awful lot of until they turn up in Milan shirt and start performing. So they're going to have another good season, transfer window like that, I would say, because there's definitely still more to be done. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they really turned on their title push this season once they've been knocked out of the Champions League, because they accelerated towards that title once they could focus only on Serie A. And I think having two or three competitions to work with is a bit challenging for the current squad.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, by the way, you mentioned Paolo Maldini, his son Daniel Maldini, part of this squad. So Paolo, Daniel, and the grandfather, Cesare Maldini, all forming part of this Maldini dynasty at Milan. How much pressure is there on Daniel to eventually have a child who plays for Milan as well, is my question.
yeah, presumably, apparently. You've got to keep it going. I mean, he's not shown huge signs that he's going to quite live up to those previous two, but you never know. Incredible, isn't it?
Quite the dynasty indeed. All right, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about Inter, we're going to talk about Napoli, Juve, and much more. Back soon.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back. We are talking Serie A with Alistair McKenzie. Let's get to Inter Milan, who finished 2 points behind AC, of course. Hakan Calhanoglu picking the wrong Milan team, it seems, this season. They did lead for 9 game weeks, but seemed to fall apart around February. They dropped a few points there. Alistair, we've had an interesting question from The Hamburglar on Twitter. What's Inter's financial situation, he says? I know their issues led to Antonio Conte leaving, but will they have to sell key pieces this summer as well? And if so, which key pieces? Obviously, you mentioned earlier in the show how a few players did depart last summer.
Yes. I mean, that was a huge kind of immediate disappointment for the Inter fans last season, because you know that title for them had been the first in 11 years, like it was for Milan this year. And then immediately Conte was gone, and Hakimi was gone, and then Inzaghi took the job, and before he knew it, Lukaku was gone, who wasn't, as Inzaghi said himself, wasn't to his knowledge that Lukaku was going to head out as well. So that left a big hole in that squad. You know, they needed someone like Conte to get them going and turn them into a title contender again. Last season, they made losses of €245 million, which isn't good. And there wasn't cash injection since then. There are a few things to consider with this, though. You know, it does seem like it's not going to be the same for the current season just finished. I mean, one of the reports I read earlier on this said that it's going to be more than halved and be more like €100 million. So a bit, you know, still a lot of money, but a lot healthier than it was last season, because obviously full stadiums again this year. They've got the money from selling those players, Lukaku and Hakimi. They've got new sponsorship deals that they've had in. And obviously they've had a run to the Champions League last 16 as well, which that's all going to help. So, I mean, I don't know for sure. I cannot give any expert insight as to the current state of Inter's finances. But I would say that this summer, they certainly aren't wrestling with the same level of financial issues as they were last summer, or it certainly doesn't seem like it. If they were to sell players, it's a good question. I think there are certainly a few. You would look at Milan Skriniar has been linked with all sorts of moves for a very long time. Alessandro Bastoni, there's been a bit of talk about him going this summer as well. very, very, very talented young centre-back. Lautaro Martinez is another one who's been linked with all sorts of moves away. It looks like they may well end up losing even Perisic too, due to not being able to agree a new contract with him. So there is a chance of this happening. I just can't quite foresee it being nearly to the same level as last year, where we had three massive figures of that title all going at the same time. Obviously, Conte wasn't sold because he was a coach, but his reasoning for leaving was that he wasn't being put in a position to improve on this because of the finances and because of the club's decision to basically sell players to raise money. Mm. So yeah, I wouldn't be as an Inter fan, you know, terrified that exactly the same thing is going to happen again, but you just never know.
Yeah, and you got me thinking when you mentioned about Milan AC Milan focusing on the league after they exited the Champions League, and Inter obviously went a little deeper and actually ran Liverpool fairly close in the end in the knockout stages. Is there a scenario where Inter weren't quite as focused on the Champions League and maybe picked up a couple extra points domestically here and there, and this was all a little different?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, Inter's squad depth is better than anyone else in the league. So I don't think they can necessarily use that as much of an excuse as other teams would. And I think it's always a very convenient thing, you know. Everyone celebrates qualifying for Europe every year and then complains about having to play in three competitions. So, that in itself was great progress for Inter, to be honest. I think I can't remember exactly how long it had been in my back of my mind. I'm thinking something like 10 years since they last got to the knockout stages of the Champions League. So for Simone Inzaghi to pull that off in his first season, having done the same thing with Lazio the year before, that was real progress. You know, that was the one stick Conte has often been beaten with, is his record in the Champions League. And Inzaghi went and outperformed him there with a worse squad. And like you say, did well against Liverpool in those games. And if it wasn't for that red card immediately after them scoring at Anfield, you never know what could have happened there. So, I think that they performed well in Europe. They went and won the Coppa Italia. They won the Supercoppa. So, you know, that's something for Inter. It's disappointing to have not won the title, but they have won two trophies. I think Inzaghi deserves massive credit for that. That means he's already won more trophies than Conte did in 1 year, having won two. So, it's not the silverware that Inter had started the season hoping for, but I think considering the level of change that they had, and also the fact that they didn't just lose players like Lukaku and Hakimi, but the ones they brought in were, you know, Edin Dzeko was Lukaku's replacement, and they still managed to take this to the final day. And, you know, it's been okay. I think for Inzaghi's first season, he's done fairly well.
Yeah, and they scored 84 goals as well. That's a pretty good tally. Certainly the best in the league this season. Do you get the impression that it's going to be the two Milan teams competing next season, or is it going to be another 3-4 horse race?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I think they should both be up there. Yeah, I mean, I would say the standard of the league as a whole has been poorer this year. But in a strange way, that's allowed the league to be more competitive. I think Milan are the only team in the top six who have actually improved. I think Roma might be 1 point better off, perhaps, than they were last season. But otherwise, I think Milan are the only one who's taken significant improvements in terms of points total from years before. So there's been a bit of a year of regression from a lot of these teams, and a lot of them really need to sort themselves out, to be honest. So it's quite hard to tell who's going to emerge from this the strongest. And I think the transfer market's going to dictate that to a large extent. But Inter should really be up there. They've got a very strong squad already. They've got a coach who seems to know what he's doing with them. You mentioned the goals, though. I think that does go back to one of the central reasons for this title race panning out the way it has. Inter haven't had problems scoring goals this season, but they've just been a bit too mad. They're known as Pazza Inter, you know, crazy Inter, and that was one of Conte's big jobs when he was in charge was, he said when he first arrived, he wanted to take the Pazza out of Inter because he'd had enough of it. But it's been very much back this season. They've had a few more kind of crazy games. And even though they're scoring all these goals, they're still not ending the season with enough points on the board. And they're still throwing away the title, really, in avoidable circumstances. It was an error from their backup goalkeeper, Yonet Radu, against Bologna, where he just lost the ball to a striker that essentially cost them the title. So it's definitely a year of regrets for them in that regard.
Certainly so. And how about Napoli? They were in the race up until a few weeks ago. What have you made of Spalletti's Napoli this year? One thing I was noticed, I looked and they've had 12 kits this year. Four different Maradona kits. A Halloween kit. Like, that's a lot of shirts, Alistair.
So what happens when you get a fashion brand to be your kit supplier? They've got Emporio Armani making their kits now. And so, yeah, it's not a huge surprise, I guess, that they are therefore wanting to get as many of them out as possible. But it's ridiculous. I mean, the Halloween one was absurd, to be honest. But, yeah, I mean, it's certainly given Napoli fans options of what to wear to the stadium, that's for sure. Yeah, they bottled it, basically. It's a shame, you know, that I think Napoli fans might end up looking back on this period of the last 5 years and think, wow, how did we not win a Scudetto in that period, whether it was under Sarri or this season under Spalletti. Like I said, this was a pretty weak field this year at the top of the table, and they had every good a chance as anyone else to come out top on top of that pile. But yeah, they just bottled it in April. They had a run of three games where they picked up 1 point and it was just gone after that. And it's a real shame because they've not won a Scudetto since Maradona was there in 1990. So they're not going to get many better opportunities where Juve are this week. Milan didn't really look ready to win a title for much of the season. And Inter were clearly flawed and a bit distracted by Europe as well. And they just had a chance. It was right there. They've got a very strong squad. They were playing fantastic football. They started on an incredible run at the start of the season. So I said there are going to be regrets for Inter from this season, but probably even more so for Napoli, given the consequences of the club's history and how rare it is for them to be in this, be in with a chance of getting that Scudetto in the first place.
Yeah, and presumably as there's going to be another big shark in the tank next season with Juventus, who finished fourth again this season, same as they did under Pirlo the previous season. Presumably, I mean, are they going to be more in contention next season? And what can we say about this season in terms of how things panned out for the old lady?
Disaster. Complete disaster. I mean, it's an embarrassment, really. It's gone even worse this year, with Allegri coming back, which was supposed to be a way of the club kind of saying, right, we've had enough of this experimenting, trying to find a way of combining winning with playing good football. Let's go back to a guy who we know will actually win the league and get us back to winning, and then we can rethink that again. And it's been a complete disaster. Allegri looks like a guy who's been out of the game for a few years. His tactics have been outdated, negative, and actually damaging. They lost the Coppa Italia final because once they went in front, Allegri switched to a back three to try and defend the lead, and they couldn't. It's been the same case all season. Disastrous, negative football. They do have a lot of good players in that squad, but they've not been able to express themselves. And in the end, Andrea Pirlo, who, let's not forget, had never coached a single game of football in his life before until starting with Juve last season. Andrea Pirlo's team scored 8 points more than Allegri's team last year. So you say that you think there'll be another team in contention next season. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I don't see anything about this Juventus team right now that makes me think they're going to be winning the Scudetto next year. And it's a crazy thing to think, really, considering we're talking about Juventus, considering the strength of their squad. But there's just been nothing on display this season to suggest that that is a team that's going to go and win a title. And I think they're going to find it very hard to go into the market and find the answers to those problems there. They're also losing their captain, Giorgio Chiellini. He's gone. Yeah. He's still been one of their best defenders. They're losing Paulo Dybala, who is their best attacker. Their midfield is a complete mess, so it doesn't matter who you lose there or not. So yeah, I don't know what's coming next for Juventus. There's a lot of questions to answer there, but Allegri's return has been shocking. It's the first time in 11 years that Juventus have finished a season without a trophy, and I think that pretty much sums it up.
Wow. And as you say, some change coming with Dybala and Chiellini leaving as well. It seems like, yeah, maybe things won't resolve next season. We shall see. Maybe one of the Rome teams is going to be in with a better shot at the top four then, Alistair.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, both of them, Roma and Lazio, will both be kicking themselves that they didn't get top four this season. If you think, considering the weakness of that Juve side, I think that really the transitions that both of those teams have been going through is the only thing that stopped them from really challenging properly. Because Lazio have, you know, it's been a huge transition for Lazio under Maurizio Sarri, a huge change of tactics, of style, of personnel, everything really. And that has taken, it took quite a while to get going for them to really find their feet. Had a very strong second half to the season. Ciro Immobile has been absolutely exceptional again, 27 goals. He's won the Capocannoniere for the fourth time, which only one person has ever done before, which was Gunnar Nordahl in the 1950s. So he's been absolutely exceptional. Roma under Mourinho have been a bit hit and miss, I think is the way to put it. Some really disappointing results, but some massive highs as well. They've really bought into the Mourinho project in Rome. You know, the stadiums have been packed. They've had, I think, 15 sellouts this season. They've had this run to the final of the Conference League as well. But despite all that, the football hasn't been particularly impressive a lot of the time. They have had some real highlights. You know, Tammy Abraham has been a superb signing for them. Absolutely banging in the goals. He's been the player who scored the most goals in a debut season for them ever. Beating Montella, beating Battistuta, you know, he's been an incredible signing for them. But I do think those two teams, they've really had transitional years. They've been working out how to play, what their strengths are, finding their feet a bit. But even despite that, they'll be looking at this season thinking, wow, this was a chance to get Champions League that's been missed out on just because of the weakness of that Juve team.
Yeah. So Lazio and Roma finishing fifth and sixth, both going into the Europa League, a point apart they were. I'll tell you what, Alistair, I've been lucky enough to go to Roma and Lazio games this season. And you're right, the atmosphere at both is phenomenal. I'd recommend any listener who's coming to Rome to go and check out a game because both sets of fans at least put on a really, really good show. But what I've noticed around the city, though, Alistair, is the cult of Mourinho you mentioned there. And you can go to the mall and they're selling shirts with Mourinho's face on them. And you didn't even see that in England when he was in his pomp there. And as you say, it feels like they've really bought into him here. And I went to Roma-Inter Milan game a few months back when I think Roma went 3-0 down in like the first, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. I think you were there as well that night.
Yeah.
And like, it was a weird atmosphere because Mourinho was there on the sideline and both sets of fans were adoring him and cheering him. But that wasn't the only thing that impressed me. It was the Roma fans for 70 minutes of this game were 3-0 down, but still just had this relentless positivity and waving the flags and getting behind the team that I've never seen anywhere else. And I don't know, does Mourinho play a part in that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I was about to say, that is not something they are known for.
Right.
Relentless positivity. I mean, it's funny because Paulo Fonseca, his predecessor, didn't get anything like this level of support. Obviously not nearly as big a name in the world of football, but Fonseca did achieve pretty much exactly what Mourinho has achieved. I mean, last season, I think he was 1 point worse off, but they got to the Europa League semi-final at the same time. Obviously, Mourinho's taken to the final, but this time in the Conference League. But yeah, they have bought into this. 100% bought into this. And whether it's Mourinho's gripes about refereeing, which have been, you know, absolutely nonstop all season, Mourinho's been driving standards, I think, is the way that people have seen it, because he's been talking about his own squad not being good enough, the transfer business not being good enough. And he can probably see the hypocrisy in what he's saying, because Roma spent more money than anyone else last summer. But Mourinho is a guy who's there to win. He's not there to hang about. And so that's what's getting these guys excited. For Roma, this Conference League final is going to be huge, because they haven't won any trophies for 14 years. They've never won a major European trophy. So there are lots of people out there who are, you know, turning their noses up at the Conference League, because obviously it's a competition that's not necessarily got the strongest field of teams in it. But for Roma, it's more about what it represents. And also, I think it'll be huge for Rome, for Mourinho to do that in his first season. I mean, everyone's really bought into his project already, but I think if he manages to actually end that trophy drought and get a European trophy, it's going to reach new heights, to be honest. And I think those T-shirts you're seeing in the shops are only going to accelerate in quantity.
Yeah, definitely so. And as we record, the Conference League is later this week, the game against Feyenoord. How excited do you sense the city is for that? I mean, I was just invited to a party to go and watch the game. And it feels like there is definitely more excitement than I would expect, say, the Conference League to generate in England or maybe other countries. It seems like, as you say, Roma fans have certainly bought into this.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the semi-final against Leicester, and it's genuinely one of the loudest atmospheres I've ever heard in my entire life. It was an incredible game. I mean, I've been to a lot of big venues, a lot of big events, but this was something else. The wall of noise that started about 2 hours before kickoff and kept going, and that was the noise of a crowd celebrating or cheering on what they see as a big event. So let's not beat around the bush here. This is viewed as being a massive, massive thing for the club. So yeah, like you say, I think it's maybe something that people were a little bit skeptical about, the creation of a third European competition and whether it's needed and so on. But I think what we've seen from the competition shows that it does have value, because it means an awful lot for a club like Roma. It also means it's going to mean a hell of a lot for a club like Feyenoord and, you know, Leicester, who Roma beat to get there too, came with a huge travelling support. So yeah, I think that it's a huge event. I mean, to underline this, Roma's fans haven't been able to go in that big a quantity to the final, because it's in Tirana in Albania and the stadium only holds 20,000. So they've opened up the Olimpico for a viewing party, and they've sold 45,000 tickets already for people to just go to the stadium and watch the game on TV screens in the stadium. So I think that kind of shows you what we're talking about here in terms of the anticipation around that.
Definitely so. Yeah, yeah. So some lucky fans got to go to Albania, and the rest of the Romans can come to the Olimpico to watch a game. That sounds fantastic. We're going to take another very quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about Serie A. We'll talk about Venezia and plenty more just after this break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics, and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick and mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth. And with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day to day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back. We are talking Serie A with Alistair McKenzie. Alistair, going a bit down the table from Lazio and Roma, we got Fiorentina in seventh, Atalanta in eighth. A little further down the table, Sassuolo, Milan's opponents, who finished in 11th this season. Milan's opponents on Sunday, I should say. I've seen them pitched as kind of the new Atalanta, a hipster's choice, Sassuolo. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, they've been a bit of a talent factory, really, in recent years. And they've also done so by kind of playing a really good standard of football. You know, under their former coach, Roberto De Zerbi, they played some phenomenal stuff. He left last summer, though. So this year, to be honest, it's really not a bad outcome for them to finish 11th under Alessio Dionisi, who's, you know, another young up-and-coming coach like De Zerbi was. You know, that's very much the mold they like to go for, like Eusebio Di Francesco, for example, in the past as well. And yeah, they have the Italy attack, basically, up front. They have Giacomo Raspadori, Domenico Berardi, and Gianluca Scamacca. And, you know, that's not obviously always the front three that Italy are going to be fielding, but they're all Italy internationals. They're all, Berardi's kind of mid-20s now, but the other two are very young players. So they are very much promoting youth, promoting attractive football, and they're always good to watch. They've also developed this amazing knack for annoying the big teams. And this is one of the reasons that Milan perhaps were a little bit uncomfortable going into that game on Sunday, even though Sassuolo were already guaranteed kind of mid-table security. They'd beaten Milan at San Siro in November, 3-1. They'd also beaten Inter, they'd beaten Juve, they'd beaten Lazio, they'd beaten Atalanta, I think it was, Fiorentina. They've essentially gone and beaten all the big teams this season. And it's an incredible feat, really, for a team of that size. They don't have a big support. You know, this is a part of the reason that the stadium was taken over by Milan fans on Sunday, is that the stadium's not even in Sassuolo. Sassuolo is a separate town from Reggio Emilia, which is, I'm not sure exactly how far away, 20 kilometres or something. Very small town. So it's a bit of an oddity, really. It's a very small club that's worked its way up the league and has now established itself as this kind of talent factory that where you can go and watch some very, very nice football. And they've still been doing that this season. So I wouldn't expect them to achieve the things Atalanta have achieved in recent years and be reaching the Champions League, reaching Europa League quarterfinals. I don't think that's a reasonable expectation for Sassuolo. But certainly if you're bored and you see that they're one of these teams that's worth watching, because they're always kind of a nice football team that are playing an entertaining brand.
Yeah, definitely so. And we didn't only have a pretty good race at the top of the table, so we had a very good relegation race in Serie A this season as well. Looking at Salernitana, I felt like they were rock bottom for like forever, and they managed to escape this one. I think 4 points separating them and Venezia, who finished bottom. So a really, really tight race at the bottom as well. Do you think the three teams, Cagliari, Genoa and Venezia, the teams who went down, were the teams that should have gone down?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible that Salernitana haven't gone down. It really is. They looked completely out of their depth after they were promoted. I think it was their first time up since 99, if I'm not wrong. And very, very quickly looked like they were nailed on to go straight back down again. They somehow turned this around thanks to, well, bringing in a number of improvements in the transfer market in January, but also having Davide Nicola. And this guy's name is worth remembering because he achieved another miracle survival a few years ago with Crotone, who were a small team from Calabria on the south coast. And they achieved a similar miracle survival where nobody expected them to stay up. They looked completely gone. He's from Turin, Davide Nicola, which is the other side of Italy. He vowed to cycle all the way from Calabria to Turin if they stayed up. And they did, and he did. And now he's gone and done the same thing again. But if anything, the Salernitana survival looked even unlikelier. But, I mean, the standard of the teams at the bottom this year has been abysmal. They've been dreadful. So the teams who have gone down deserve to go down. Venezia, sadly, just never really looked experienced enough, cut out for this level. They also really faded badly after a good, strong start. Genoa have got really what's been coming to them for a long time. This is a team with the kind of wage budget of a top half team. They really should be up at the other side of the table, not down fighting relegation, but that's where they've been every year. Every year they've been swapping coaches every few months. They had three this season. And I think, to be honest, in my opinion, I think Genoa is a club that needs to go down to sort themselves up and come back up and do it properly, because they've just been scraping by for too long now. Cagliari, likewise, big surprise. You look at their squad and you think, again, mid-table at least. And they've been dreadful this season. And last night, Salernitana, there was a shootout for the last relegation spot between Salernitana and Cagliari. Salernitana lost 4-0. They bottled it in spectacular fashion, really, at home to Udinese, who had nothing to play for. And yet Cagliari still couldn't muster a goal against Venezia, who are already relegated. It's the dream game for them to have at the end of the season. All they needed to do was beat Venezia, and they couldn't. They couldn't really even get that close. So I think that the three teams who've gone down in the end can't really have any complaints, and it's been yet another kind of miraculous effort from Davide Nicola to keep an unfancied team up.
Yeah, definitely so. Owen Davis on Twitter has asked, what are the big things that led to Venezia's relegation? You've dug in there a little bit already, Alistair, but obviously there's a bit of American interest in this team with Gianluca Busio and the American ownership there. They're a team I facetiously refer to as the Venice fashion brand because of their lovely, lovely shirts. But, I mean, do you see them coming back up? How badly did they do this season, basically?
Not that badly. I mean, you know, it was always a big ask for them. You know, they were a small club as a promoted club, and the team they kind of came up with was pretty inexperienced at this level, and they started pretty well. I mean, at the midway stage, they weren't in the relegation zone. They were on course to survive. Paolo Zanetti, their coach, was getting a lot of plaudits as being, you know, perhaps a next big thing kind of coach in Italy, given his efforts. But they just really bombed since the turn of the year. They didn't have a good January in terms of the players they brought in. You know, Nani was brought in, for example, and they just never really managed to get the kind of player they could rely on to score goals up front. They also had this awful habit of conceding late, and I don't know the exact figures. I don't have them on me, but I imagine if you looked at how many points Venezia threw away in the last 5-10 minutes of matches this season, it would not be very nice reading for them. So that was a real issue, maybe a mentality issue. I'm not sure. But they won two games in 2022. And eventually Zanetti was sacked in April, and it just it was too little too late, really. They couldn't do enough. I mean, you know, it has been a nice season, I guess, for them in some ways. They came up and tried to play nice football. You know, they didn't just try and soak up pressure and squeeze out results. They did try and play. I really enjoyed having them in the top flight. I went to watch Venezia against Genoa back in February, and it is an absolutely amazing, unforgettable day out, because you have to take the traghetto, you know, the one of the little ferries to get there. You arrive at the stadium by boat. You walk along the canal to get into the ground, and it's this tiny little stadium. And over the back of the stand where you're sitting, there's, you know, a kind of marina sitting with yachts there and everything. It's an amazing place to watch football, really. And it's an incredible thing that was a Serie A venue, to be honest. So, I really, really enjoyed having them there. But ultimately, that lack of quality and that complete collapse really in the second half of the season is what did them.
All right, Alastair, you've mentioned sort of the quality of this season, but how have you felt it's gone entertainment-wise? When you look back at this season, maybe if you look back in a year or two, will you think, yeah, that was a great campaign? Or will you think, well, you know, the quality was a bit low? How do you think you'll perceive it?
I think it's been fantastic, because it's been a massively competitive field. You know, it's pretty rare to have on the final day a relegation battle, one place yet to be decided, to have two teams fighting for the title at the top, and on top of that to have European places still to be decided as well. I mean, that is pretty much all you can ask for from a league season, is to be given that kind of climax. So, yeah, it's been great drama. There's been fantastic storylines all the way through it. And, yeah, like I said, although I think the standard of the teams, both at the bottom and the top, has been pretty poor, actually, it's not taken away from the overall experience of the season. It's been a fantastic season to watch. There have been some incredible moments. But it's hard to know where it goes from here. Like I said, when you were asking about the title race before, it's very difficult now to predict what happens from here, which of these top teams emerges contenders, whether it'll be the Milan teams again, or whether it's going to be Juve coming back into, or if Napoli can strengthen, or even if one of the two Rome clubs can really kick on from these first transitional seasons. What happens to Atalanta now? You know, is their eighth place finish a sign that their cycle under Gasperini is over, or is this just a blip and they'll be back? So it's actually really, really hard to answer these questions. And if you've been watching Serie A for the last decade, like I have religiously, that is a really good place to be, because for 9 years in a row, Juventus were winning it every single season, and rarely, with a few exceptions, were they being properly challenged. So that it's really, really good to have it back as being a proper competitive league again, and with everything that goes with that.
My final, potentially very difficult question for you, Alastair, is about next season's Champions League. This season, for the first time in quite a while, I believe we have both Milan teams competing in the Champions League, but no Italian team made it past the quarterfinals, I think, this season. Do you see an Italian team going deep again in Europe's top competition next year?
It was the last 16, both Inter and Juve knocked out this season.
Yeah.
I still think there's a huge gap there, and sadly it keeps getting bigger as UEFA kind of wave through every single possible measure introduced to allow the rich, powerful clubs to get more rich and more powerful. And Italy's been a bit left behind in that regard. It is a little bit amusing, to be honest, that Juventus are in the situation they're in, having been one of the founders of the Super League. But I just cannot see an Italian team competing to win the Champions League as soon as next year. I don't think any of them are even close to the standard that's been set by your Man City's, your Liverpool's, your Real Madrid's. I don't think that over two legs any of these top Italian sides are there yet. I think they can compete. Hopefully someone can have a run. It would be nice to see someone get further than the last 16. And I also hope that beyond that, that the teams start giving a proper show themselves in the other competitions, because it's almost like a cultural thing that beyond the Champions League for too long, the Europa League, people have been snobby about. Now there's the Conference League, which people had opportunities to be even more snobby about. But Roma have shown this season that there is a lot of joy and pride to be taken from that kind of competition. So I really hope that not just in the Champions League, but in the Europa League, the Italian teams can have a proper go of it and try and own those kind of competitions. I thought the Europa League was fantastic this year. It was a really, really good competition. Fantastic to have clubs like Rangers and Frankfurt in the final instead of, you know, Man United, for example, or Chelsea, who have been there in recent years, were essentially just dropping down out of the Champions League. So, yeah, I think that it's probably too much to ask at this point for the top Italian clubs to be winning the Champions League, but I do think it's possible in the lower two competitions.
All right, Alistair McKenzie, a real pleasure to talk to you today about Calcio. Thank you so much for joining us. It's plugs time. I'll give you one more chance to tell us where we can find you. Tell us about your podcast.
I'm not very good at this, but the only real place to find me is on Twitter at AKS McKenzie, and pretty much everything I write or do, I will annoy everyone with on there and share. So, yeah, just give me a follow in there and we can take it from there. And if there are, like I said at the start, any English-speaking Lazio fans out there who's been wondering where you can hear about Lazio every week, then I'm also battering on about them all the time on Lazio Lounge podcast. So you can just search for that online and you'll find it very easily.
Wonderful stuff. Alistair, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Listener, thank you very much. We'll be back on the feed with another one. But for now, catch you later. You gotta smash it.